The things he envisioned for the future often came to pass, even if it took a few centuries. Scuba gear, flying machines, and helicopters now exist. Suction pumps now drain swamps. Along the route of the canal that Leonardo drew, there is now a major highway. Sometimes fantasies are paths to reality. Chapter 25. Michelangelo and the Lost Battles. The Assignment. The commission that Leonardo received in October 1503 to paint a sprawling battle scene for Florence's council hall in the Palazzo della Signoria could have become one of the most important of his life. Had he completed the mural along the lines of the preparatory drawings he made, the result would have been a narrative masterpiece as captivating as The Last Supper, but one in which the motions of the bodies and the emotions of the minds would not have been constrained by the confined setting of a Passover Seder, as The Last Supper was. The finished work might have matched the emotional whirlwind that the Adoration of the Magi hinted at being, except wrought much larger. But as with so many of his projects, Leonardo ended up not finishing the Battle of Anghiari, and what he painted is now lost. We can envision it mainly through copies. The best, which shows only the central part of what would have been a much larger mural, is by Peter Paul Rubens, which was made from other copies in 1603 after Leonardo's unfinished work was covered up. See figure 91 in the PDF. Heightening the significance of the commission was the fact that Leonardo would end up pitted against his personal and professional young rival, Michelangelo, who was chosen in early 1504 to paint the other large mural in the hall. Even though neither painting was finished, like Leonardo's, Michelangelo's work is known to us only through copies and preparatory drawings. The saga provides a fascinating look at how the contrasting styles of Leonardo, then 51, and Michelangelo, 28, each transformed the history of art. Florence's leaders wanted Leonardo's mural to be a celebration of a 1440 victory over Milan, one of the few examples of Florence's triumph on the battlefield. Their intent was to exalt the glory of their warriors, but Leonardo aimed to create something more profound. He had intense, conflicted feelings about war. After long fancying himself a military engineer, he had recently gained his first close-up experiences of war in the service of the brutal Cesare Borgia. At one point in his notebooks, he called war a most beastly madness, and some of his parables espouse pacifist sentiments. On the other hand, he had always been captivated and even beguiled by the martial arts. As we can see from his preparatory drawings, he planned to convey the enthralling passion that made war so gripping, as well as the brutality that made it so abhorrent. The result would have been neither a commemoration of conquest, like the Bayeux Tapestry, nor an anti-war statement like Picasso's Guernica. In his own nature and in his art, Leonardo's attitude towards war was complex. The location for the proposed painting was immense. It was to adorn almost one-third of the length of a 174-foot wall that was in the imposing meeting chamber for Florence's Signoria, or ruling council, on the second floor of what is now called the Palazzo Vecchio. See figure 92. The hall had been expanded in 1494 by Savonarola so that it would seat all 500 members of the Grand Council. With Savonarola gone, the leader of the council was known as the Gonfaloniere, or standard-bearer. That helped Leonardo determine what would be the central element of his Battle of Anghiari mural, the fight for the standard at the climax of the battle. Leonardo was given workshop space for himself and his assistants in the Pope's room, in the cloisters of the Church of Santa Maria Novella, which was large enough to accommodate his full-size preparatory drawing. Machiavelli's secretary, Agostino Vespucci, provided Leonardo with a long narrative description of the original battle, including a blow-by-blow chronicle involving 40 squadrons of cavalry and 2,000 foot soldiers. Leonardo dutifully placed the account in his notebook, using a spare bit of the page to draw a new idea for hinged wings of a flying machine, and then proceeded to ignore it. He decided instead to focus on an intimate struggle of a few horsemen flanked by scenes of two other tight skirmishes. The conception. The idea of painting a battle scene that was both glorious and horrifying was not new for Leonardo. He had written a long description more than 10 years earlier when he was in Milan of how it should be done. He paid particular attention to the colours of the dust and smoke. First, you must represent the smoke of artillery mingling in the air with the dust tossed up by the movement of horses and the combatants, he instructed. The finest part of the dust rises highest, hence that part will be the least visible and will look almost the same colour as the air. At the top, where the smoke is more separate from the dust, the smoke will assume a bluish tinge. He even specified how the dust clouds would be kicked up by the horses. Make the little clouds of dust distant from each other in proportion to the strides made by the galloping horses, and the clouds which are furthest removed from the horses should be the least visible. Make them high and spreading and thin, and the nearer ones will be more conspicuous and smaller and denser. He went on to describe, with his conflicted mix of fascination and repulsion, how to portray the brutality of battle. If you show a man who has fallen to the ground, show the place where he has been dragged as bloody mud. A horse will drag the body of its dead rider, leaving traces of the corpse's blood in the dust and mud. Make the vanquished look pale and panic-stricken, their eyebrows raised high or knitted in grief, their faces stricken with painful lines. His account, more than 1,000 words long, got more lurid as he warmed to his task. The brutality of war didn't repulse him as much as it seemed to mesmerize him, and the goriness he described would be reflected in the drawings he made for his battle mural. You must make the dead covered with dust, which is changed into crimson mire where it has mingled with the blood issuing in a stream from the corpse. The dying will be grinding their teeth, their eyeballs rolling heavenward as they beat their bodies with their fists and twist their limbs. Some might be shown disarmed and beaten down by the enemy, turning upon the foe to take an inhuman and bitter revenge with teeth and nails. Some maimed warrior may be seen fallen to the earth, covering himself with his shield, while the enemy, bending over him, tries to deal him a deadly blow. Just the thought of war brought out Leonardo's dark side and transformed the gentle artist. There must not be a level spot that is not trampled and saturated with blood, he concluded. His passion is visible in the frenzied sketches he drew in 1503 as he threw himself into his new commission. The drawings. Leonardo's initial drawings for the Battle of Anghiari show various moments of the battle, including one of cavalcades of infantry swarming to the scene, another of the Florentine troops arriving, and one showing them racing away with the battle standard that the Milanese carried. But gradually he tightened his focus on a single skirmish. The scene he finally chose for his central section was of 3 Florentine horsemen grappling the standard away from Milan's defeated but still defiant general. In one preparatory drawing in the series, see figure 93, Leonardo used quick and sharp brown ink strokes to show the fury of the 4 horses and riders struggling. On the lower half of the page, he sketched 9 versions of a nude soldier in frenzied twists as he swings a lance. Another drawing in the series shows soldiers being trampled, dragged, and lanced by the furious horsemen, just as he had described in his notebook. His depictions of the frantic clash of men and horses are messily tangled, yet also gruesomely precise. One shows massive steeds rearing up and crashing down on naked soldiers squirming on the ground. The riders clinging atop the horses thrust lances into the bodies of the fallen. On another sheet, he sketched a soldier beating a writhing enemy warrior who is also being lanced by a horseman. The brutality is frenzied, the savagery chaotic. Leonardo's astonishing ability to use simple pen strokes to capture movement has reached its peak. If you stare long enough at the pages, the horses and bodies seem as vibrant as a video. He planned the expressions on the faces with great care. In one preparatory chalk drawing, he focused on the face of an old warrior, his bulging brows furrowed and nose wrinkled as he stares down and shouts with rage. See figure 94. From the brows to the eyes to the mouth, Leonardo displayed his mastery of conveying emotions with every element of a face. His anatomy studies had taught him which of the facial muscles that move the lips also affect nostrils and brows. That allowed him to follow his own directions, written a decade earlier, on how to show an angry, anguished face. The sides of the nose should have certain furrows, going in an arch from the nose and terminating at the edge of the eyes. Make the nostrils drawn up, causing these furrows and the lips arched to disclose the upper teeth, with the teeth parted, in order to shriek lamentations. This sketch ended up being the model for the central warrior in his final full-size drawing for the painting. Leonardo had long been fascinated by horses, which he obsessively drew and even dissected when he worked on the equestrian monument for Ludovico Sforza in Milan. In his preparatory drawings for the Anghiari mural, he re-engaged in the subject. His possessions at the time included a book of horses sketched for the cartoon, and they display the same intensity of motion and emotion as the human faces he drew. Vasari was among those impressed by how Leonardo was able to make the horses as much a part of the physical and emotional battle as the humans. Rage, fury, and revenge are perceived as much in the men as in the horses, two of which have their forelegs interlocked and are fighting no less fiercely with their teeth than those who are riding them. In one of these drawings, see figure 95, Leonardo used a frenzy of chalk strokes to combine two sequential instants, like a stop-action photographer or a precursor to Duchamp. The technique allowed him to convey the horse's wild lurching and lunging as it engaged in the battle with an intensity equal to that of its rider. In his best drawings, Leonardo amazes us by capturing the world precisely as an observant eye would see it. In the case of the wildly charging horses, he goes even further by capturing motion in a way that our eye cannot see. They are among the greatest evocations of movement in the entire history of art, the British art critic Jonathan Jones wrote. Movement, something that had obsessed Leonardo ever since he had tried to catch the blur of a cat's squirming limbs in an early drawing, is here clarified as a theme with blood-red intensity. On another page from his book of horses, he demonstrated how a horse could display emotion like a human. See figure 96. There are six horse heads, each showing a different degree of anger. Some bare their teeth and, like the old warrior, furrow their brow and flare their nostrils. In the midst of these boldly drawn horses, he lightly sketched, as if for comparison, the head of a man and of a lion with analogous expressions of fury, their teeth bared and furrowed brow thrust forward. Here we have a cross between a piece of art and a study in comparative anatomy. What began as a preparatory drawing, and indeed had elements that found their way into the battle scene he began to paint, also became, in inimitable Leonardo fashion, an investigation into muscles and nerves. For a final reminder of how varied his passions and curiosities were, we can turn over the page of horse sketches to see what else he was thinking about at the time. The reverse of the sheet also has an energetic sketch of a horse's head, but above it is a carefully rendered schematic of the solar system, showing the Earth and Sun and Moon with projection lines explaining why we see the various phases of the moon. In a note, he analyzed the illusion of why the moon appears larger when it is on the horizon than when overhead. "Look at an object through a concave lens, and it will seem bigger," he wrote. "And by this means you will have produced an exact imitation of the atmosphere." On the bottom of the page are some geometrical illustrations of a square and slices of a circle, as Leonardo pursued his never-ending quest to transform geometric shapes into other shapes of the same area and to solve the challenge of squaring a circle. Even the horse seems a bit awed and reverential, as if it is marveling at how Leonardo has scattered around it the evidence of his amazing mind. The painting. Leonardo's immersion in his preparatory studies, which were driven by his passionate curiosity more than the mere utility of sketching out a painting, meant that he was not progressing as fast as the Signoria would have liked. At one point, a pay dispute erupted. When he went to get his monthly fee, the cashier gave it to him in small coins. Leonardo refused the money. "I am no penny painter," he objected. As the tension escalated, he raised money from some friends so he could pay back his fee and abandon the project. But the gonfaloniere of the Signoria, Piero Soderini, brother of the diplomat who had negotiated with Borgia, refused the repayment and convinced Leonardo to go back to work. A revised contract was signed by Leonardo and witnessed by his friend Machiavelli in May 1504. By then, the Florentines were beginning to worry about Leonardo's proclivity to procrastinate, so they wrote into the new contract that he would have to repay all his fees and forfeit all the work he had done if he did not finish by February 1505. The document declared, "Several months ago, Leonardo, son of Ser Piero da Vinci and a Florentine citizen, undertook to do a painting for the Sala del Consiglio Grande, and seeing that this painting has already been begun as a cartoon by the said Leonardo, he moreover having received on such account 35 florins, and desiring that the work be concluded as soon as possible, the Signoria have resolved that Leonardo da Vinci is to have completely finished painting and brought it wholly to perfection by the end of next February without quibble or objection. And in the event that Leonardo shall not have finished in the stipulated time, then the Signoria can compel him by whatever means appropriate to repay all the money received in connection with this work, and Leonardo would be obliged to make over to the said Signoria as much as had been done." Soon after signing this new contract, Leonardo constructed a scissors-like platform that, Vasari reported, was raised by contracting it and lowered by expanding. He requisitioned 88 pounds of flour to make a paste with which to stick up his preparatory cartoon, and the ingredients for whitewash to prepare the wall. After spending a few months at the end of the year on his swamp draining and military mission to Piombino, he returned to the Battle of Anghiari in early 1505. As with the Last Supper, Leonardo wanted to paint his mural using oil-based pigments and glazes, which enabled him to create luminous illusions. Oil permitted him to paint more slowly, with finer brushstrokes and greater nuance of colour and shadow transitions, which would have been particularly suited for the hazy and dusty atmospheric effects he intended for the Battle of Anghiari. Because there were already signs that his use of oil on dry plaster was causing the Last Supper to flake away, Leonardo experimented with new techniques. Unfortunately, painting on walls was one endeavour where his quest for innovation and scientific experimentation repeatedly failed him. For the Battle of Anghiari, he treated the plaster wall with what he called Greek pitch, pece greca per la pittura, probably a dark residue of distilled turpentine or a mix of resin and wax. His list of provisions also included almost 20 pounds of linseed oil. His small experiments with these materials seemed to work, so he became confident he could use them for the entire mural. But almost immediately, he noticed that his mixtures were not sticking well. One early biographer said that Leonardo was cheated by his supplier and that the linseed oil was faulty. To dry the pigments and perhaps concentrate the oil, Leonardo lit a fire below his painting. The February 1505 deadline came and went with the painting not close to completion. He was still making his delicate oil brushstrokes on the wall in June when all was almost ruined by a torrential rainstorm. "Friday the 6th of June, 1505, at the stroke of the 13th hour I began to paint in the palace," he recorded in a notebook. His brief description of the scene is unclear, but it seems to indicate that the storm caused great leaks that overwhelmed the vessels used to remove the water. "As I lowered the brush, the weather changed for the worse and the bell started to toll, calling the men to the court. The cartoon was torn, water poured down, and the vessel of water that was being carried broke. Suddenly the weather became even worse, and it rained very heavily till nightfall." This entry is considered by some a notarial recording of the momentous day he first began painting the Battle of Anghiari, but I think not. He had signed his new contract and requisitioned materials a year earlier, and he had probably been working on and off since then. There is no other case when he recorded the moment of starting or finishing a painting, but he regularly wrote about storms, deluges, and other weather phenomena that stimulated his apocalyptic imagination. I suspect his notebook entry was prompted by the storm rather than some painting milestone. Vasari, who saw Leonardo's unfinished painting, described it vividly. An old soldier in a red cap crying out grips the staff with one hand and, raising a scimitar with the other, furiously aims a blow to cut off both the hands of those who, gnashing their teeth in the struggle, are striving in utmost fierceness to defend their banner. On the ground, between the legs of the horses, there are two figures that are fighting together, and the one on the ground has over him a soldier who has raised his arm as high as possible, and thus with greater force he may plunge a dagger into his throat in order to end his life, while the other, struggling with his legs and arms, is doing what he can to escape death. It is not possible to describe the invention that Leonardo showed in the garments of the soldiers, all varied by him in different ways, and likewise in the helmet crests and other ornaments, not to mention the incredible mastery that he displayed in the forms and lineaments of the horses, which Leonardo, with their fiery spirit, muscles, and shapely beauty, drew better than any other master. In trying to complete this painting and make it stick to the wall that summer of 1505, Leonardo could feel the presence of a younger man looking over his shoulder, both literally and figuratively. Preparing to paint a competing mural in the room was the rising star of Florence's art world, Michelangelo Buonarroti. Michelangelo. When Leonardo left Florence for Milan in 1482, Michelangelo was only 7 years old. His father was a member of Florence's minor nobility, who subsisted on small public appointments. His mother had died, and he was living in the countryside with the family of a stonecutter. During the 17 years that Leonardo was away in Milan, Michelangelo became Florence's hot new artist. He was apprenticed to the thriving Florence workshop of the painter Domenico Ghirlandaio, won the patronage of the Medici, and travelled to Rome in 1496, where he carved his Pietà, showing Mary grieving over the body of Jesus. By 1500, the two artists were back in Florence. Michelangelo, then 25, was a celebrated but petulant sculptor, and Leonardo, 48, was a genial and generous painter who had a following of friends and young students. It is enticing to think of what might have occurred if Michelangelo had treated him as a mentor, but that did not happen. As Vasari reported, he displayed instead a very great disdain toward Leonardo. One day, Leonardo was walking with a friend through one of the central piazzas of Florence, wearing one of his distinctive rose-pink, rosato, tunics. There was a small group discussing a passage from Dante, and they asked Leonardo his opinion of its meaning. At that moment, Michelangelo came by, and Leonardo suggested that he might be able to explain it. Michelangelo took offense, as if Leonardo were mocking him. "No, explain it yourself," he shot back. "You're the one who modelled a horse to be cast in bronze, was unable to do it, and was forced to give up the attempt in shame." He then turned and walked away. On another occasion, when Michelangelo encountered Leonardo, he again referred to the fiasco of the Sforza horse monument, saying, "So those idiot Caponi Milanese actually believed in you." Unlike Leonardo, Michelangelo was often contentious. He had once insulted the young artist Pietro Torrigiano, who was drawing alongside him in a Florence chapel. Torrigiano recalled clenching my fist and giving him such a blow on the nose that I felt bone and cartilage go down like biscuit beneath my knuckles. Michelangelo had a disfigured nose for the rest of his life. Combined with his slightly hunched back and unwashed appearance that made him a contrast to the handsome, muscular and stylish Leonardo. Michelangelo's rivalries extended to many other artists, including Pietro Perugino, whom he called a clumsy goffo artist. Perugino unsuccessfully sued him for defamation. "Leonardo was handsome, urbane, eloquent, and dandyishly well-dressed," wrote Michelangelo's biographer Martin Gayford. In contrast, Michelangelo was neurotically secretive. He was also intense, dishevelled and irascible, according to another biographer, Miles Unger. He had powerful feelings of love and hate towards those around him, but few close companions or protégés. "My delight is in melancholy," Michelangelo once confessed. Whereas Leonardo was disinterested in personal religious practice, Michelangelo was a pious Christian who found himself convulsed by the agony and the ecstasy of faith. They were both gay, but Michelangelo was tormented and apparently imposed celibacy on himself, whereas Leonardo was quite comfortable and open about having male companions. Leonardo took delight in clothes, sporting colourful short tunics and fur-lined cloaks. Michelangelo was ascetic in dress and demeanour. He slept in his dusty studio, rarely bathed or removed his dogskin shoes, and dined on bread crusts. How could he fail to envy and detest the easy charm, the elegance, refinement, amiable sweetness of manner, dilettantism, and above all the scepticism of Leonardo, a man of another generation, said to be without religious faith, around whom there constantly strutted a crowd of beautiful pupils led by the insufferable Salai, wrote Serge Bramley. Soon after his return to Florence, Michelangelo was commissioned to turn a hulking and imperfect piece of white marble into a statue of the biblical Goliath slayer David. Working with his usual secrecy, by early 1504 he had produced the most famous statue ever carved. See figure 97. 17 feet high and dazzlingly bright, it instantly eclipsed all previous statues of David, including the pretty boy version by Verrocchio, for which the youthful Leonardo served as a model. Verrocchio and others had portrayed David as a young boy in triumph, often with Goliath's head at his feet. But Michelangelo showed him as a man, starkly nude as he prepared to go into the fight. His stare is alert, his brow determined. He stands with an air of affected casualness, in a contrapposto position, his weight on one leg, the other thrust forward. As Leonardo did in painting, Michelangelo showed the body in motion, torso twisting gently to the right, neck to the left. Though David seems relaxed, we can sense the tension in the muscles of his neck and see the veins bulging on the back of his right hand. Florence's leaders were then faced with the question of where to place this astonishing colossus. The issue was so contentious that there was even an outbreak of stone throwing by some protesters. Being a republic, Florence formed a committee. 30 or so artists and civic leaders were convened to discuss the issue, including Filippino Lippi, Perugino, Botticelli, and of course Leonardo. They gathered on January the 25th, 1504, in a meeting room near the Duomo, in sight of the finished statue, and considered 9 locations, 2 of which became finalists. Michelangelo originally hoped that his statue would stand outside the entrance to the cathedral on the Piazza del Duomo, but he soon realized that it was better as a civic symbol of Florence and urged that it be placed on the piazza in front of the Palazzo della Signoria. Giuliano da Sangallo, who was one of Florence's best architects as well as a sculptor, favoured a site underneath the wide arch Loggia della Signoria, a building on the corner of the piazza. He and his supporters made the argument that tucking the David there would best protect it from the elements, but that choice also had the effect of making it less prominent, dominant, and visible. "We will go to see it, and not have the figure come to see us," said another supporter of the Loggia location. Not surprisingly, Leonardo came down on the side of stashing it inside the portico. When it was his turn to speak, he said, "I agree that it should be in the Loggia, as Giuliano has said, but on the parapet, where they hang the tapestries." Clearly, he preferred that Michelangelo's statue be put in an inconspicuous space. Leonardo went on to add something surprising. He argued that the statue be installed with decent ornament, con ornamento decente. It was clear what he meant. Michelangelo had sculpted David unabashedly naked, with prominent pubic hair and genitalia. Leonardo suggested that a decent ornament should be attached in such a way that it does not spoil the ceremonies of the officials. In his notebook at the time, he drew a small sketch based on Michelangelo's David. See figure 98. "Look carefully, and you can see what he is suggesting. He has discreetly covered David's genitals with what looks like a bronze leaf." Leonardo was not generally prudish about nudity. From his Vitruvian Man to his portraits of Salai, he merrily drew naked men, and in his notebooks he once wrote that the penis should be displayed unashamedly. Indeed, A red chalk and ink nude he drew in 1504, around the time of the statue placement discussions, seems to combine in a psychologically interesting way the fleshy face of Salai, then 24, with the muscular physiognomy of Michelangelo's David, see figure 31. He also did sketches of a nude and muscular Hercules, front and back, that were probably for a statue he hoped someday to make as a counterpoint to David. Yet there was something about Michelangelo's version of muscular, intrusive male nudity that Leonardo found disagreeable. Michelangelo won the battle of placement. His David was carefully rolled from his workshop over a four-day period and installed at the entrance of the Palazzo della Signoria. It stayed there until 1873, when it was moved inside the Accademia Gallery, and in 1910, a replica was placed in front of what had by then been renamed the Palazzo Vecchio. But Leonardo won his argument that a decent ornament should be added. A gilded garland made of brass and 28 copper leaves was strapped on, covering David's genitals. It stayed there for at least 40 years. The competition. As soon as his statue of David was placed in the most prominent spot in Florence's civic plaza, Michelangelo was commissioned to paint a battle scene that would be a companion to Leonardo's in the Great Hall. To the Signoria and its leader, Soderini, the decision was a conscious effort to play off the rivalry between the era's two greatest artists. Accounts from the time all use the same word for it, concorrenza, or competition. At the funeral of Soderini, years later, a eulogist praised him by saying, "To stage a competition with Leonardo, he assigned Michelangelo that other wall, where Michelangelo, to conquer him, began to paint." The near-contemporary artist and writer Benvenuto Cellini, in praising Michelangelo's cartoon, stated, "He made it in competition with another artist, Leonardo da Vinci." And Vasari used the same word. While that rarest of painters, Leonardo da Vinci, was painting in the Great Council Hall, Piero Soderini, then gonfalonier, because of the great ability he saw in Michelangelo, got part of that hall allocated to him, which was how it came about that he did the other facade in competition with Leonardo. The subject assigned to Michelangelo was another of Florence's rare battlefield victories, this one over Pisa in the Battle of Cascina in 1364. Like Leonardo, he failed to complete his painting. And once again, we know it only through copies of the full-scale preparatory cartoon he drew, including one made by his pupil Bastiano da San Gallo. See figure 99. Rather than focusing on a climactic event, as Leonardo did with his battle for the standard, Michelangelo chose to portray an oddly tangential scene, one that featured more than a dozen muscular and naked men. This is the moment when Florence's soldiers were bathing in the Arno River and received an alarm that the enemy was attacking, causing them to scramble up the banks and grab their clothes. A rare event in military history that centered on nude, wet men, it was a scene suited for Michelangelo, who had never been to war or seen a battle, but was infatuated with the male body. "In all his works, Michelangelo was drawn to the nude," Jonathan Jones wrote. "Here he flaunted it as an obsession, drew attention to his habit, dramatized his penchant." Anyone who hadn't registered before that young Michelangelo was utterly besotted with the bodies of men was certainly going to notice now. Leonardo rarely criticized other painters, but after seeing Michelangelo's bathing nudes, he repeatedly disparaged what he called the anatomical painter. Clearly referring to his rival, he mocked those who draw their nude figures looking like wood, devoid of grace, so that you would think you were looking at a sack of walnuts rather than the human form, or a bundle of radishes rather than the muscles of figures. The phrase "un sacco di noce" amused him. He used it more than once in his attacks on Michelangelo's muscular nudes. "You should not make all the muscles of the body too conspicuous, otherwise you will produce a sack of walnuts rather than a human figure." Therein lay another difference between the two artists. Michelangelo tended to specialize in muscular male nudes. Even when he painted the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel a few years later, he included 20 ignudi, athletic nude males, as corner figures. Leonardo, on the contrary, prided himself on the universal nature of his subjects. He believed the painter should aim at universality, because there is a great want of self-respect in doing one thing well and another badly, as many do who study only the nude figure and do not seek after variety, Leonardo wrote. This is a defect that demands stern reprehension. He could certainly draw and paint male nudes, but his virtuosity came from his imagination and inventiveness, which required diversity and fantasy. Let the painter composing narrative pictures take pleasure in variety, he directed. Leonardo's broader critique of Michelangelo was his argument that painting is a higher form of art than sculpture. In a passage written just after the showdown of battles in the Florentine Hall, Leonardo argued, "Painting embraces and contains within itself all things perceptible in nature, which the poverty of sculpture cannot do, such as show the colors of all things and their diminution. The painter will demonstrate various distances by the variation of color of the air interposed between objects and the eye. He will demonstrate how the species of objects penetrate mists with difficulty. He will demonstrate how mountains and valleys are seen through clouds in the rain. He will demonstrate dust itself, and how the combatants raise a commotion in it." Leonardo, of course, was referring to Michelangelo's sculptures, but judging from the extant copies, his criticism also applied to Michelangelo's Battle of Cascina and even some of his finished paintings. In other words, he painted like a sculptor. Michelangelo was good at delineating forms with the use of sharp lines, but he showed little skill with the subtleties of sfumato, shadings, refracted lights, soft visuals, or changing color perspectives. He freely admitted that he preferred the chisel to the brush. "I am not in the right place, and I am not a painter," he confessed in a poem when he embarked on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel a few years later. A look at Michelangelo's oil and tempera panel painting Donitondo, see figure 100, done around the time of the Signoria competition, shows the difference between the styles of the two men. Michelangelo seems to have been influenced by the cartoon Leonardo had done for the Virgin and Child with St. Anne, which had caused a sensation when displayed in Florence. Michelangelo's version has a similar narrative feel, with the characters twisting in a tight configuration, but there the similarities end. Michelangelo prominently includes Joseph. For reasons best left to Freud, Leonardo never conspicuously featured Joseph in any of his art. Though vividly coloured, Michelangelo's three main figures seem sculpted rather than painted. They are lifeless, and their expressions lack charm or mystery. His background features not nature but his favourite motif, male nudes, lounging languorously and a bit pointlessly, even though there is no river for them to bathe in. They are in sharp focus, with no sign of Leonardo's understanding of atmospheric or distant perspective. "He had no use for Leonardo's famous sfumato," writes Unger. Gayford calls Donitondo almost a rebuttal in paint of Leonardo's ideas. Michelangelo's painting has the sharp, delineated outlines that Leonardo, with his love of sfumato and blurred borders, scorned as a matter of philosophy, optics, mathematics, and aesthetics. To define objects, Michelangelo used lines rather than following Leonardo's practice of using shadows, which is why Michelangelo's look flat rather than three-dimensional. The sharply lined contours are also featured in his Battle of Cascina, as shown in some of his preparatory studies. It is as if he had looked at Leonardo's method of creating a dusty and hazy battle scene blurred by motion, as well as the sfumatura in Leonardo's other works, and decided to do just the opposite. Their divergent approaches represent two schools in Florentine art, that of Leonardo, Andrea del Sarto, Raphael, Fra Bartolomeo, and others who emphasize the use of sfumato and chiaroscuro, and the more traditional approach taken by Michelangelo, Agnolo Bronzino, Alessandro Allori, and others who favor a disegno based on outlined contours. Abandoned. In the spring of 1505, with his painting for Florence's council hall not yet begun, Michelangelo accepted a summons from Pope Julius II to Rome to sculpt a tomb. As if energized by Michelangelo's absence, Leonardo threw himself into painting his battle scene. But then the temperamental Michelangelo had a temporary falling out with the Pope, who he felt was not being deferential enough. Artists such as Leonardo and Michelangelo were reaching such a status that popes and marquesas had to defer to them on occasion. "You can tell the Pope that if he wants me from now on, he can seek me elsewhere," Michelangelo declared, and returned to Florence around April 1506. His presence back in Florence unnerved Leonardo, who as usual was both procrastinating and having difficulty getting his oil-based paint mixtures to adhere to the wall. He would eventually move back to Milan, consigning the Anghiari mural to his long list of abandoned projects. Michelangelo too would leave again, kneeling to ask the Pope's forgiveness and then returning to Rome. He would stay there for another decade and paint the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel. So neither painting was ever finished. The final loss of both men's work came at the hand, ironically, of Vasari, the painter-biographer who lionized them. He was commissioned in the 1560s to renovate the Great Hall, where he painted 6 battle scenes of his own. In recent years, a group of experts, including the high-technology art diagnostician Maurizio Seracini, discovered some evidence that Leonardo's partial painting may still exist under one of Vasari's. Tiny holes drilled into Vasari's work revealed pigments on the wall underneath that may be from Leonardo's painting. But authorities have resisted requests to allow further investigations that might harm Vasari's mural. Once again, we have to wrestle with the reasons Leonardo decided to leave a work unfinished. The proximate cause was the problems he had with his materials. "Conceiving the wish to colour on the wall in oils," Vasari reported, "he made a composition of so gross an admixture to act as a binder on the wall that when he painted, it began to peel off in such a manner that in a short time he abandoned it, seeing it spoiling." Added to that was the unnerving spectre of Michelangelo hovering behind him. Leonardo did not have a competitive personality, so he likely did not relish the contest. There was also a more artistic challenge, I think, that contributed to Leonardo's decision to abandon the commission. When painting The Last Supper, he became immersed in the difficulty of getting the proper visual perspective in a large mural that would be seen from multiple vantage points in a room. A conventional central point perspective scheme would have made parts of the scene appear distorted. Other painters would not have noticed, or would have chosen to ignore the way figures in a large painting could seem disproportionate when viewed from different parts of the room. But Leonardo was obsessed by the optics, mathematics, and art of perspective. For The Last Supper, he had come up with tricks and illusions and artifices to make his work appear realistic from different vantages. He was able to make a preferred vantage point that was far away from the painting. He calculated it would ideally be located 10 to 20 times as far away as the painting was wide. But the area that he was supposed to paint in Florence's Council Hall was 55 feet long, twice that of The Last Supper. And his mural would be viewed from at most 70 feet away, far less than twice its width. In addition, his painting was supposed to be an outdoor scene lit by broad daylight, unlike The Last Supper, which depicted an enclosed dining room on the wall of an enclosed dining room. The challenges of how to get all of the perspectives from each angle to look believable were combined with the difficulties of showing direct and reflected lighting and shadows in an open-air scene that was to be viewed inside a room. Leonardo had the authorities cut 4 more windows in the hall, but that did not eliminate the challenge. He was a perfectionist faced with challenges other artists would have disregarded, but that he could not. So he put down his brushes. That behavior meant he would never again receive a public commission. But it is also what allowed him to go down in history as an obsessed genius rather than merely a reliable master painter. School of the World. The unfinished battle scenes turned out to be 2 of the most influential lost paintings in history, and they helped to shape the High Renaissance. These battle cartoons of Leonardo and Michelangelo are the turning point of the Renaissance, according to Kenneth Clark. They were kept on display in Florence until 1512, and young artists flocked to see them. One of those was the sculptor Cellini, who described the competing display in his autobiography. These cartoons stood one in the Medici Palace and the other in the Pope's Hall, and so long as they remained there, they served as the school of the world. Raphael travelled to Florence just to see the two cartoons that had caused such a sensation, Vasari reported, and he drew versions of them. The animated details of both unfinished works spurred the imaginations and the mannerism of subsequent generations. Frenzied faces, monstrous armour, twisting bodies, convoluted poses, masks, and mad horses. Between them, the two great council hall images provided 16th-century artists with a banquet of oddities, Jonathan Jones wrote. In these fantastical works, two geniuses tried to outdo one another in sheer quiddity. The showdown did more than any paragone could have to raise the status of artists. Leonardo and Michelangelo had become luminaries, paving the way for other artists, who until then had rarely even signed their work, to do the same. When the Pope summoned Michelangelo, and when the Milanese vied with the Florentines over the services of Leonardo, it was recognition that super artists had their own recognizable style, artistic personality, and individual genius. Instead of being treated as somewhat interchangeable members of the craftsman's class, the best artists were now treated as singular stars. Chapter 26. Return to Milan. The death of Ser Piero. In the midst of Leonardo's struggle to paint the Battle of Anghiari, his father died. Their relationship had been complex. Piero da Vinci never legitimated Leonardo, but perhaps that was an act of intentional or unintentional kindness as well as coldness. Had he done so, Leonardo may have been expected to become a notary, despite guild rules that made that difficult, and Piero knew that vocation would not suit him. He helped his son get at least 3 major painting commissions, but he also drew up stringent contracts designed to force him to deliver. When Leonardo failed to do so, it likely caused strain between them. After not marrying Leonardo's mother, Piero had 4 wives. The last 2 were much younger than Leonardo, and with them Piero had 9 sons and 2 daughters, many of them sired when he was in his 70s. Leonardo's half-siblings were all young enough to be his children, and they didn't regard him as a potential family heir. The difficult family dynamics became evident when Piero died. Leonardo, imperfectly displaying his notarial heritage, recorded the event in his notebook. He seemed agitated. On a page filled with lists of his expenditures in July 1504, including 1 florin to Salai to spend on the house, he wrote the following. On Wednesday at 7 o'clock died Ser Piero da Vinci on the 9th of July 1504. There was one little oddity. July 9th that year was a Tuesday. Then Leonardo did something even more unusual. On the top right of another page, which contains some typical geometric drawings and a few columns of added numbers, he had the information repeated in a sloping script written in the conventional left-to-right manner. If you look at the manuscript carefully, you can see that the note is in a different ink from the rest of the page. The fact that it is carefully scribed in a normal direction indicates that it may have been dictated to one of his assistants. It begins, Wednesday at 7 o'clock. The next word would likely have been died, but the line breaks off and is crossed out. On the next line, the text begins anew. On the 9th of July, 1504, Wednesday at 7 o'clock, died Ser Piero da Vinci, notary at the Palazzo del Popolo, my father, at 7 o'clock, being 80 years old, leaving behind 10 sons and 2 daughters. Again, there is something wrong with the day, and this time he has stated the hour twice. He also got his father's age wrong by 2 years. Piero was only 78. In saying that Piero had 10 sons, Leonardo was counting himself. Nevertheless, his father did not bequeath him any inheritance. Despite his advanced age and the fact that he was a notary, Piero had not made a will. Although he may not have made an active decision to disinherit Leonardo, he knew that dying intestate meant his property would be divided among only his legitimate sons. Perhaps he felt that leaving money to Leonardo wasn't necessary because he was already successful, though in fact he was never comfortably wealthy. Or maybe Piero thought an inheritance would make his son even more negligent about completing commissions. More likely is that Leonardo was not legally an heir, and with their relationship strained, Piero felt no reason to change that. He had brought Leonardo into this world as an illegitimo, had not legitimized him as a child, and on his death, delegitimized him yet again. Leaving Florence. The first time he moved away from Florence to Milan in 1482, Leonardo left the adoration of the Magi as merely a cartoon. When he decided to move the second time in 1506, he left with the Battle of Anghiari, similarly promising, but unpainted. He would end up making Milan his home base for 7 years, with only temporary visits back to Florence. His excuse for going to Milan this time was to resolve the dispute over the second version of Virgin of the Rocks. He and his partner on the work, Ambrogio di Predis, had not been paid, and they had taken the matter to court. An arbitrator in April 1506 ruled against them, saying that the painting was imperfetto, a word connoting unfinished as well as imperfect. Specifically, the judgment was that there was not enough of Leonardo's hand in it, so he was required to come add his own finishing touches before payment would be made. If he had wished, Leonardo could have deflected the demand that he return to Milan by forfeiting any more payments for the Virgin of the Rocks. Money had never dictated his actions, plus he would have earned just as much if he stayed in Florence and finished the Battle of Anghiari. He heeded the summons to Milan because he wanted to go there. He had no desire to continue to struggle with his battle scene, compete with a younger artist who painted like a sculptor, or live in a town with his half-siblings. The Florentine authorities reluctantly let him leave at the end of May 1506, partly for diplomatic reasons. Florence had been protected from Borgia and then other potential invaders by the French king Louis XII, who then controlled Milan and admired the Last Supper and its artist. Louis expressed his desire to have Leonardo return to Milan, at least temporarily, and Florence's leaders were afraid to refuse. However, they did want Leonardo's stay to be temporary, so they required him to sign a notarized document pledging to return in 3 months. His bank manager had to co-sign and commit to pay a penalty of 150 florins if he failed to do so. The final payment for Virgin of the Rocks, when he did collect it, was only 35 florins. When Leonardo's 3 months were almost up, it became clear that he would not be returning to Florence anytime soon. To stave off Florentine demands, or a forfeiture of his florins, he had his French patrons launch a protracted and amusing barrage of diplomatic démarches. In August 1506, Charles d'Amboise, the French governor of Milan, sent two missives, one polite and the other more abrupt, saying that, in spite of all previous promises, Leonardo needed an extension of his leave from Florence because he had not finished all of the projects the king wanted. Florence's leaders acquiesced with the understanding that he would come back at the end of September. Unsurprisingly, that did not occur, and in early October, Florence's gonfaloniere Soderini lost patience. He sent a letter that attacked Leonardo's honour and threatened Florence's relations with Milan. Leonardo has not behaved as he should have done towards the Republic, because he has taken a large sum of money and only made a small beginning on the great work he was commissioned to carry out, he wrote. We do not wish any further requests to be made on this matter, for this great work is for the benefit of all our citizens, and for us to release him from his obligations would be a failure of our duty. But Leonardo stayed in Milan. Charles d'Amboise sent a flowery and polite rebuke to the Florentines, asserting, with some merit, that Leonardo was loved in Milan and, by implication, underappreciated in Florence, especially when it came to his engineering skills. We were among those who loved him even before our eyes had rested upon him, and now, since we have known him and been much in his company, and have had personal experience of his various gifts, we truly see that his name, famous in painting, is relatively obscure so far as those other branches of knowledge in which he has reached so great a height. Although he agreed that Leonardo would be free to return to Florence if he wanted, he added a reproach couched as a mischievous recommendation that the Florentines should treat their native son better. If it be fitting to give a man of such talent a recommendation to his fellow citizens, we recommend him to you as strongly as we can, and assure you that everything you can do to increase either his fortune and well-being, or those honours to which he is entitled, would give us, as well as him, the greatest pleasure, and we should be much obliged to you." At that point, King Louis, who had by then appointed Leonardo his official painter and engineer, Nostre peintre et ingénieur ordinaire, intervened personally from the French court at Blois. Summoning Florence's ambassador, he firmly requested that Leonardo stay in Milan until his own arrival there. "Your signoria must render me a service," he insisted. "He is an excellent master, and I desire to have several things from his hand, certain little Madonnas and other things according to my fancy, and perhaps I shall ask him to do a portrait of me," he told the ambassador. Florence's leaders realized they had no choice but to please their military protector. The signoria replied, "Florence cannot have any greater pleasure than to obey his wishes. Not only the said Leonardo, but all other citizens are at the service of his wishes and needs." Leonardo was therefore still in Milan in May 1507, when Louis made a triumphant visit, having quelled a rebellion in Genoa on the way. The procession was led by 300 armoured soldiers and a triumphal chariot bearing the cardinal virtues and the god Mars, holding in one hand an arrow and in the other a palm. To celebrate the king's arrival, there were days of festivals and pageants, and Leonardo was, of course, involved in choreographing them. A tournament was held in the plaza, and Isabella d'Este, her desire for a Leonardo portrait still unfulfilled, was at the masked ball. After Savonarola, the Republic of Florence was restrained in its indulgence of such fêtes, but Milan still relished them, which was another reason Leonardo loved Milan. Francesco Melzi. While in Milan in 1507, Leonardo met a 14-year-old named Francesco Melzi. See figure 101 in the PDF. He was the son of a distinguished nobleman, who was a captain in the Milanese militia and later a civil engineer who worked to reinforce the city's fortifications, endeavours that fascinated Leonardo. The Melzis lived in the largest villa in the town of Vaprio, on a river overlooking Milan, and Leonardo often stayed there, making it a second home. Leonardo was then 55, and he had no son or heir. Young Francesco was an aspiring artist, pretty in the slightly soft way of Salai, and possessing some talent. With his father's permission, he was effectively adopted by Leonardo, either through an informal agreement or a legal contract, one that would be honoured in Leonardo's will a decade later. Leonardo became a mix of legal guardian, godfather, adoptive father, teacher, and employer of the young Melzi. Although the decision may seem strange in our day, it was an opportunity for the Melzis to have their son become the pupil, heir, and amanuensis of a charming and beloved family intimate, who also happened to be the most creative artist of the time. Afterward, Leonardo stayed close to the entire Melzi family, even helping to design improvements to the family's villa. For the rest of Leonardo's life, Francesco Melzi would be by his side. He worked as Leonardo's personal assistant and scribe, drafted his letters, kept his papers, and preserved them after his death. He wrote in a graceful italic, and his notations are to be found throughout Leonardo's notebooks. He also was Leonardo's art student. Though never a master painter, he was a good artist and draftsman who made some respectable drawings, including a famous one of Leonardo, and copied many of Leonardo's works. With his talent, efficiency, and steady temperament, he was a devoted companion to Leonardo, and a less complicated and devilish one than Salai. Years later, the biographer Vasari got to know Melzi and wrote that he was a very beautiful boy, bellissimo fanciullo, and much loved by, molto amato da, Leonardo. Those are similar to the words Vasari wrote of Salai, but it is unclear whether in this case there was any romantic or sexual relationship. I doubt there was. It is unlikely that Melzi's father would have given him over to Leonardo for such an association, and we know that after Leonardo's death, Melzi married a prominent noblewoman and had 8 children. Like much of Leonardo's life, there is a cloak of mist over the truth about the full extent of their relationship. What is clear is that their relationship was not only close but familial. Leonardo drafted a letter to him in early 1508 that displays both fondness and vulnerability. "Good day, master," messer, a salutation that respects his noble rank, "Francesco. Why in God's name have you not answered a single one of all the letters I sent you? You just wait till I get there, and by God I'll make you write so much you'll be sorry." There follows another draft of a letter to Melzi that is slightly more reserved. It describes a question that needed to be resolved about the water rights the king had granted Leonardo as a payment, and notes, "I wrote to the superintendent and to you, and then I repeated it and never had an answer. So you will have the goodness to answer me as to what happened." The letter mentioned that Leonardo was sending the messages by the hand of Salai, who was then 27. That raises the question of what Leonardo's longtime companion thought of this new, younger, aristocratic, and far more polished member of the household. We know that both stayed by Leonardo's side for the next decade of his life, and that Melzi made a higher salary. There is a clue that Leonardo needed to work at keeping peace with Salai. It was around this time in 1508 that the dictated note mentioned earlier appeared in one of his notebooks. "Salai, I want peace, not war. No more wars, I give in." Whether or not Melzi was ever a lover, he became something more significant. Leonardo loved him as a son, and he needed a son to love. It helped that Melzi was appealing and pretty, which was no doubt one reason Leonardo liked to have him in his retinue. But he was also a loyal and caring companion to whom Leonardo could pass along his papers, his estate, his knowledge, and his wisdom. He could help mold him as he would have a son. By 1508, that was all the more important to Leonardo. As he passed through his 50s, his notebooks show intimations of his awareness of his mortality. His father had died. His mother had died. He was estranged from his half-brothers. He had no family other than Francesco Melzi. Florence Interlude. An Inheritance Battle. It was an inheritance dispute with his half-brothers rather than the exhortations of the Signoria or any desire to resume painting the Battle of Anghiari that brought Leonardo back to Florence temporarily in August 1507. After he failed to inherit anything from his father, his beloved uncle Francesco da Vinci, a gentle and unambitious country squire who had been like a doting brother or surrogate father, decided to make up for it. With no children of his own, Uncle Francesco changed his will and, when he died in early 1507, left his estate to Leonardo. This apparently contradicted an understanding that his property would go to Piero's legitimate children, and they sued Leonardo. The main issue was over a piece of farmland with two houses 4 miles east of Vinci. For Leonardo, it was a matter of principle as well as property. He had lent his uncle money to improve the farmhouse, and he occasionally visited there to conduct experiments and make drawings of the surrounding landscape. The result was another of the angry draft letters to be found in his notebooks. It was addressed to his half-brothers, but was written partly in the third person, perhaps because he had someone send it on his behalf. "You wish the utmost evil to Francesco," he wrote. "You do not wish to repay his heir the money he lent for the property. You have treated Leonardo not as a brother, but as a complete alien." The King of France came to Leonardo's aid, hoping to speed his return to Milan. He wrote to the Signor